So, welcome to Marketing 25 out of 10, Lecture 11, February 22nd. Anybody birthday today? You're 22,
22?
Couple folks, yeah?
Oh,
we need somebody who's also turning 22. February 22nd, never mind. All right, lecture notes, page 95. Yes, I hit the record button. Masks. All right, so we've been telling you about this for a couple sessions now. So if you were interested in sales and marketing fair to meet folks, internships, potential jobs, or just to get used to that process, that's today after class-ish, 7:30, 8:30 in the Kent Student Center, or virtually Thursday. We know that extra credit number 3 is open closing Thursday. We know mini test 5 closes tonight. We know midterm 1 opens on Wednesday. We get on all those little details, right? We know that after midterm 1 closes, I'll be posting your midterm grades as required by the university. What else we got? Enhanced earning extra credit number 3, close on Thursday. Here's the results from the mini test 4. Okay, what else? I mean, this is repetitious stuff. Of course, then I still get people asking me what's going on. So midterm 1 closes 5 p.m. a week from Wednesday, 5 p.m. last log on. Don't wait until 4:59 to log in. You're going to have a problem, right? So, but 5 p.m. is the last log in. That's different than 11:59. Different than 11:59, Webbies, it's 5. So pay attention to that deadline, too. Covers what was in mini test 1 to 5 that closed tonight. That's lectures 1 to 10. 50 questions. Do I have to do all this? Do we know this? All right. Proctorio, anybody bother? I just posted it like today. Anybody bother with that sample mini test yet to see how that works? Okay, so it does give you a chance to jump in and see what it looks like when you have to get your camera working and your microphone working and the recording of the screen working. So if you're hesitant to jump into the midterm right away, try the sample midterm. Is that what I just said? Sample midterm. See how it works? The difference is you still have to putter with your ID for the actual exam. All right, the rest of the stuff is stuff that we know about. You don't need a code or a password. Even if it asks you for it, look for the proctorial help. Study for the exam. Really study. Bring your notes. Bring your book. Don't cheat. Okay. The sample midterm does not count in your class grade, but it gives you a chance to go see what's going on. Before you attempt any of the exams, reboot your computer. Have no other programs running. You'll need a picture ID for the actual test. All right. So, any questions for me? I just feel like I'm wasting a little time here going over what we went over. Any questions for me on the midterm? We're good on that? Webites? Questions for me? All right, so business in the news. Coke and Pepsi earnings show big sales gains on big price increases. So Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola have reported higher quarterly sales as the global soda giants pushed through price increases, but also felt the squeeze of higher costs for commodities and transportation. So, of course, price is part of the marketing mix, and these economic factors impacting business. Coke's organic revenue increased 9% in the quarter ended December 31st, driven by a 10% increase in prices. Organic revenue at PepsiCo, which also sells Doritos, Lay's, potato chips, and other packaged goods, rose 11.9% with a 7% increase in prices. By the way, if we're not familiar with the term organic revenue, how many people do know the term, know what it is? No? So from accounting, right? So organic revenue strips out currency swings, acquisitions, divestitures. It's just focused on the core business. That's what we mean when we say organic revenue. Coke said the fourth quarter of 2021 was the first period since the pandemic start that the volume of its sales in restaurants and other eat-in venues was ahead of 2019 before the nasty pandemic hit us. The COVID-19 pandemic in 2020 shut restaurants, bars, restaurants, stadiums, and movie theaters around the world. The impact of the pandemic closing things down, and then the impact as it begins to wrap up. PepsiCo's chief executive, Ramon LaGuarta, said that recent price increases haven't turned away consumers. We have consumers following us in spite of higher prices, which goes to this interesting idea of the price elasticity of demand. And I think if we weren't observing this in real time, And I asked you 2 years ago in class, why are you back in 2 years? Never mind. 2 years ago in class, what would happen if cola prices went up 10%? What would happen to demand? I think you'd say, it would drop. It's cola. People aren't going to put up with that. Yet, in these set of situations, demand has kept up even though prices have increased. Counterintuitive a little bit, I would say. Coke and PepsiCo, two of the world's biggest advertisers, so they ramped up market spending during the most recent quarter. Coke, an Olympic sponsor, has been running an Olympics-themed marketing campaign in China, though not in the U.S. or in other markets. PepsiCo boosted marketing in the quarter around National Football League ahead of the Super Bowl game. So here's our global marketing strategy. What we do in China, we don't necessarily do in the U.S. or other parts of the world. And our promotional strategy. Both companies have been revamping their product portfolios to adapt to changing consumer tastes. Yay! Discovery and satisfaction of consumer needs, wants, and desires, and adapting to their changes. Coke in November struck a $5.6 billion deal to take full control of Body Armor, a sports drink that's been growing sales faster than Coke's soda business. Again, I reflect with you back to that product portfolio stuff, the Boston Consulting Group stuff we talked about. How fast is the market growing? How big a player are we? Lays out whether this thing's a dog, a star, et cetera, for us. So this is part of that strategic view of the world. PepsiCo recently closed on the sale of its Tropicana juice business, which has been posting sales slower than other units. So for them, that was a dog, or at least a question mark, if not a dog. So recall product portfolio analysis, a la the Boston Consulting Group, adapting marketing to changing consumer tastes with our overall strategy. PepsiCo isn't currently exploring any new acquisitions, saying the company, which also owns Gatorade, Mountain Dew, Cheetos, and Quaker Oats, has sufficient brands to fuel its current strategy. So there's its marketing strategy. Don't misinterpret that to mean that they aren't puttering with the brands they own and coming out with new flavors and new, you know, things about them. They're just not planning on any major acquisitions in the immediate future. Why KFC censored half of its slogan? KFC's 64-year-old slogan is known all over the world, so it's blank, blank good. What's that stand for? It's finger-licking good, which, by the way, my wife, who's a little fussy at that kind of stuff, she hates the idea of people licking their fingers. It gives her shivers. But anyhow, so when the fast food chain was forced to close all of its doors due to COVID-19, it needed to find a new way to stay salient at a time when finger-licking was against the advice of medical professionals and felt inappropriate. So we're seeing a bit about working with our global brand image, a bit about global marketing, and of course, once again, the effects of the pandemic. Ignoring industry advice to, quote, play it safe, KFC and creative partner Mother London went for a brand out approach that would pull on KFC's brand story and decided to blur out its most iconic asset instead. So they ran a bunch of ads, not in the US, but in other parts of the world, where they blurred out finger licking, so now it just says it's blur blur good, and they got a lot of attention for it. So Q, it's blank blank good, KFC's first global marketing campaign that would go on to boost the brand's word of mouth by 3,800% and win KFC the 2021 Marketing Week Masters Award for PR and brand storytelling. So certainly we got consumers' attention and generated word of mouth, or if you will, buzz with this campaign. The campaign announcement was treated like a major public information campaign. KFC went hard, eager to reach as many people as quickly as possible. The brand was public about it, so people knew that what they were seeing and what everyone was seeing. And KFC used retargeting and personal media to remind people of and reinforce and extend the campaign. If you're not familiar with the term retargeting, retargeting campaigns remind website visitors of your products and services after they leave your website without buying. So, you know, when you go over to Facebook, suddenly you're seeing ads pop up for whatever thing you just visited last. KFC ramped up engagement by pixelating the lines on huge images of KFC buckets and replacing them with crowdsourced suggestions for alternatives for blank blank. The campaign was covered in 97 countries and received over 2 billion impressions globally. That's pretty good. It achieved over 600 pieces of media coverage in the United Kingdom alone, reaching 83% of United Kingdom adults across national, broadcast, consumer, and regional titles, while influencer partnerships and new slogans and the new slogans generated just under 7 million impressions with an average engagement rate of 4.31%. So there's some global marketing from KFC, all without using the KFC slogan even one time because it was blurred out. So we're about to talk about global marketing, hence this story. And the next one, Taco Bell fans, Taco Bell. Taco Bell guacamole fans. I guess guacamole isn't big here. All right. Taco Bell says it's not affected by the U.S. import ban on Mexican avocados, thanks to a distinction in U.S. custom laws. How many people heard about this ban on avocados from Mexico? A bunch of us have. The U.S. recently banned the importation of avocados from, I don't know how to say that, from Mexico, which exports about $3 billion of avocados annually, but some restaurants, including Taco Bell, are still able to serve guacamole. Let's think about that for a second. So we're seeing the impact of regulatory, legal, political factors on marketing. We're seeing global marketing issues. Avocado imports, like other fruits and vegetables, are governed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA. About 80% of avocados consumed in the U.S. are imported from Mexico. So restaurants that rely on them could be looking at tough times and high prices ahead. Again, supply, demand, and pricing. Taco Bell, which sells guacamole as part of its menu of Mexican-style fast food, doesn't have to worry, though. The chain imports guacamole, not whole avocados. So Taco Bell is not impacted by the U.S. halting avocado imports from Mexico because we import guacamole, not avocados. Guacamole is a processed food and governed by different rules than avocado, which is its main ingredients, says John Amato, Director of Trade Services at Trade and Export Control Solutions. So we're seeing regulatory, legal, political factors, and the nuances of those things in business. Everything that comes across the border has its own number used for product identification, he explains, and avocados and guacamoles are classified differently. Remember that NACIS code stuff we looked at when we were talking about bearings, for example? All the products traded in North America have their special code. These guys are classified different in that code system. The avocado ban began because a U.S. safety inspector received a threatening phone call. It will remain in place for as long as necessary to ensure the appropriate actions are taken to secure the safety of APHIS personnel working in Mexico, referring to the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. Experts say California isn't able to produce enough avocados to meet demand. California supply EcoFarm says wholesale clients are ready, reaching out about securing their supplies. Prices could increase as much as 25%. Supply chain issues, price in the mix. Chipotle fans? Oh, at least as many as taco fans. Chipotle workers make fresh guacamole daily in stores. The chain has only just weeks of inventory available and said it's working to use its network to bring in avocados from other regions, including Peru. So issues of global supply chain. So working with other nations of the world is usually a good idea, usually benefits everybody, usually works pretty smoothly, except when it doesn't. All part of the thinking about how you're going to work with your suppliers, etc. All right, so we pick up with lecture notes, page 95, page 165 in the textbook, finishing chapter 6, understanding organizations as customers, and beginning chapter 7, understanding and reaching global consumer markets. By the way, I should have here, as a reminder then, this starts the material on mini test 2. Okay, so this is the new material moving forward. So we were still talking last time about understanding organizations as customers. And here we have a little comparison chart where we compare sort of something in the B2C and the B2B market. What we're looking at here is a consumer purchase who's thinking about a student buying a smartphone, versus an organizational purchase of a company thinking about buying an earbud headset for a smartphone. So they aren't exactly the same. So problem recognition, the first stage in the decision process, whether we're a B2C or a B2B situation. The student doesn't like the features of the new smartphone they own now, and they want a new one. Whereas in the B2B world, marketing research and sales departments see that the competitors are improving their earbud headsets for their smartphones. The firm decides to improve on the earbud headsets on its own new models, which will be purchased from an outside supplier. Somewhat different problems, I don't like my phone, I want a better phone for me. Our competitors are coming up with better things and features in their phone. We need to keep up with the change. Information search, the student uses past experience, talks to friends, ads, the internet, consumer reports to collect information and uncover alternatives as possible solutions for a new smartphone. B2B side of things, design and production engineers draft the specifications for headsets. The purchasing department identifies potential suppliers of the earbud headsets that meet these specs. Alternative evaluation, choosing among the various things we come up with during search. For the consumer, the alternative smartphones are evaluated on the basis of important attributes desired in a phone. Several stores are visited. So what are you most interested in? Are you most interested in memory, speed, whether it's an iPhone or not an iPhone, the camera? What interests you? On the business side, purchasing and engineering personnel visit with suppliers. They assess the facilities, the supplier's capacity, their quality control standards, their financial status. You don't want to start up with a new supplier that's about to go out of business. That wouldn't make any sense. They drop any suppliers that are not satisfactory on these factors. Purchase decision, the consumer decides a specific brand of smartphone. They pay the price, and they go off with their phone. In the B2B world, they use quality, price, delivery, technical capabilities as key buying criteria to select a supplier. Then, usually the purchasing agent is going to negotiate the terms and award the contract to the supplier. After the purchase, the student reevaluates the purchase decision, may return the phone to the store if they don't like it. In terms of the B2B world, they're going to have some sort of formal vendor rating system that they will apply to this new vendor. They'll notify the supplier if the earbud headsets don't meet their quality standards, and if the supplier can't resolve the issue, they'll drop the firm out of the contract and, as a future supplier. So obviously somewhat different ways of going through that decision process in a B2C versus a B2B environment. So let's think about a little example. How many folks know Hershey's? Like Hershey's. Is it okay, chocolate? Yeah, it's okay. All right, so Hershey's recognized in a B2B domain a problem. The problem was diabetes. Diabetes, when I put this together, 18 million Americans had it. It was growing at a 10% rate annually, and consumers wanted a nice, sweet product that wouldn't harm the, you know, wouldn't cause more problems with their diabetes. So Hershey starts looking around. What can we do to help this these consumers? They had to find a sugar substitute that was right for them and their consumers. So they needed to come up with the technical specifications for a sugar substitute. What would that be? Well, it has to appeal to consumers, right? The taste has to work for the consumers. The texture, the dietary needs have to be met. Then we have to make sure that it fits our own production specifications, right? So it has to be easy to use. It has to be available in sufficient quantities at our specs. It has to be reasonable cost. Now we begin to evaluate the potential suppliers of the product. Marketing, production, and research people jointly evaluate these potential suppliers of this substitute. Maybe we find that we need more information. So we go out and we contact university food science researchers to get additional information on alternatives and how they meet all these criteria. Pretty elaborate. We're going to eliminate any of those that don't have the taste and texture, availability, and the cost that we're looking for as we move down the suppliers. Eventually, then, we make a purchase decision. We set a contract with a supplier to supply us with this new substitute product. So we buy the sugar substitute, integrate it into our marketing mix for the new sugar-free products, and we market those products. Hopefully, we're successful. Then we see how well this goes. And indeed, it went pretty well for Hershey's. They have Jolly Rancher sugar-free, Twizzler sugar-free, Reese's sugar-free, Hershey's chocolate candy sugar-free, Hershey's syrup sugar-free. So they were able to come up with an interesting new line of products to satisfy this particular problem, people with diabetes who wanted a sugar substitute food. So we judge how well did the supplier of the sugar substitute do, how successful were the new products in the marketplace, did consumers need, want, value them, did they buy them? How about Sephora? Sephora launches on Instagram checkout with over 80 brands. Instagram checkout may be able to help Sephora further grow the brands that it sells. So we're interested in how we're going to grow our business. Instagram checkout. Anybody know or use Instagram checkout? Is that a thing you know about? Okay. So Instagram checkout is a B2B service that allows a brand's users to make a purchase without ever leaving Instagram. So now we have a streamlined two-tap process converting Instagram followers into loyal customers for brands on Instagram. It's helping Sephora to open another channel and one that's frequently turned to for discovery as consumers go to Instagram to look up new products. Sephora said in its press release that the platform allows these brands to scale their business while also providing a connected beauty buying experience across different platforms. So B2B figuring out how they're going to grow their product on Instagram and help other brands sell their products. So just as in your world, e-commerce is really a big deal in the B2B world. So online buying in organizational markets is a big thing. Old days, as I talked about before, purchasing agents had big fat catalogs and they'd have to flip through the catalogs and find products. Computers weren't a thing yet. Then it was computerized, but not yet available on the internet, so you'd have to look it up and then put in a paper order. Now, of course, just like you, they're in the world of e-marketplaces, including things like online auctions as a factor in organizational markets. So in a traditional auction, a seller puts up an item for sale. Various bidders bid in competition to buy that product. And the more bidders you get, the more upward price you have, pressure on price, because everybody's putting in another bid. So the auction ends when a single bidder remains. How many of you guys have bought something in an online auction where you're bidding against other people? And what did you use? eBay is the example, same thing. Okay, and so you're sitting there and you're waiting to see if they put in a higher bid, and then you decide if you're going to put in a higher bid sort of thing. Sort of the same thing in the world of business. Here's for the visual learners. You have one seller of a single product, and as the number of buyers increase, more buyers drive the price up, a way that B2B, just like eBay, sells products in the commercial world. We also, though, have the idea of a reverse auction. A reverse auction is where a buyer puts out into the e-commerce world that they need a particular product or service, and they want to know, can you provide it? How much would it cost me? In this case, various suppliers bid in competition for the business. As the number of suppliers increase, there's a downward pressure on prices. And when the auction ends, when a single bidder, a single supplier is left. So it's the opposite effect. More and more suppliers come in. I can provide that to you for only $100,000. I can do it for $95,000. Bid it down to a single bidder is left. So there is the image of a reverse auction, and there's actually information out in the world. I think we still have this. So here's actually a document on out of IBM, reverse auction, saving money and increasing transparency, bidding in a reverse auction environment. So it's a thing out there. All right, so that wraps up our discussion of trying to understand the B2B world and organization as customers from a marketing perspective. So we're into chapter 7, Understanding and Reaching Global Consumers and Markets, lecture outline pages 97. There's a variety of ways to grow your business. So far, probably in our mind, we've been thinking mostly about what we would do domestically, probably. But we certainly want to know what we can do globally as well. So why do we think about international trade? Why is it a big deal? Well, first of all, in some cases, you need to get access to materials or products or services which are simply not available domestically. Or they're available domestically, but at a higher price or lower quality or with less technology. Your particular product needs diamonds. Which state is the best provider of diamonds? Delaware? Texas? Washington State? I'm not too sure we have too many good choices for diamonds. There may be some in the U.S. If you need diamonds, where are you probably going to have to go? Everybody knows where diamonds come from. Africa, of course, and then you get into a whole other thing about blood diamonds versus good diamonds, and you're really caught up in that sort of trap of slaved-out diamond mining, but that's not the main point. You're not going to find it in Ohio. You got to go internationally. So international trade is important if you need something that isn't available here. Or you might be engaging in international trade to reach markets that want your materials or products or services. If you're going to grow and people somewhere else non-domestically want them, let's talk about export. Or there are issues of comparative advantages. Some countries simply have unique national or human resources that give them a competitive edge internationally. We'll talk more about what that means by some examples a little bit. But some nations, not just by resources, but by human talent, have competitive edges that make it worthwhile you thinking about going internationally. Or your home market is saturated. Just how many more Starbucks do we need domestically? I haven't been out on campus as much as I should, but in non-COVID times, where's the nearest Starbucks to where we stand right here? Right on the corner of the business. And where's the next closest one? Down the library, and then down at the bottom of the street, and then down the street from that. How many more do we need? Maybe our market's saturated. Maybe we have to grow by going somewhere else. Potential demand, I've sort of alluded to that. Folks may want our stuff. Customer expectations, you're talking about a B2B environment. Your clients are going to go international. They need you to go international too. Are you going to do it? Are you going to let them go? So there are a variety of reasons to think about this idea of international trade. When we think about international trade, we certainly have to think about e-commerce globally. The pandemic led to a surge in online spending in the biggest shopping revolution in the West since malls and supermarkets. But it's in China, not the West, where the future of e-commerce is being staked out. The China market is bigger, more creative, and tech firms there are blending e-commerce, social media, and more to become the online shopping business for 850 million digital consumers. That's a good-sized market. The China e-commerce market overtook the U.S.'s in 2013, and today is worth more than $2 trillion, more than the U.S. and Europe e-commerce markets combined. The China e-commerce market is dynamic, highly competitive, leading to innovations such as demolishing the boundaries between different types of services that still are silos separated in the West. They blend digital payments, group deals, social media, gaming, instant messaging, short-form videos, and live streaming celebrities on single platforms. In the West, Visa specialized in payments, Amazon in e-commerce, Facebook in social media, Google in search. The West is largely underestimating this global competition that we have in China. Wake up, pay attention. Multinational firms like Unilever, L'Oreal, and Adidas make more revenue in Asia than in America. And they look there, not to California or Paris, to see the latest in digital marketing, branding, and logistics. Ouch. To be competitive, some Western companies are diversifying. Facebook promotes shopping services on its social networks and engages in social commerce, including live streaming and the use of WhatsApp for messaging between merchants and the shopper. Walmart hosted its first live shopping event using TikTok, a Chinese-owned app. From electronics to solar panels, Chinese manufacturing advances have been ignored or dismissed as copying by the West, then downplayed and then grudgingly acknowledged around the world. Today, it's the Chinese consumer tastes and habits that are going global. Might it be important for us to pay attention to international trade? Sounds like it. So what does this mean to the United States? Well, we talk about the balance of trade. The balance of trade is the difference between the monetary value of a nation's exports and imports. Does the U.S. import more or export more, would you say? It imports more. It exports more. Okay? In fact, what we find is that, well, first of all, what we see is the red are the exports, the green are the imports. So as we can see, we import a lot more than we export. So this means we have a negative balance of trade. Now, exports are up over time. You can see the trend line there going up. I mean, you know, a little up and down, but exports are up over time. But what's the point about export versus imports? Imports are up even more. So what does this mean? We have a negative balance of trade. Now, this is certainly important for governments to pay attention to, economists to pay attention to. As a business person, my thinking is there's money to be made on importing. There's money to be made on exporting. Let the governments worry about the right balance. You might just engage in importing or exporting as a business transaction as appropriate for your market and your consumers against your competition. But there's a policy issue there. We certainly do want firms to come to Ohio to do business. We want to engage in importing. Ohio is the 9th largest exporting and 11th largest importing state in the nation. Within a one-day drive of most U.S. major metros, the Cincinnati region's location means products arrive at the customer's door faster. Our strong logistics industry moves large and small items via air, river, rail, or road. I think I have the actual, there we go, this is the actual Jobs Ohio link talking to you why you should invest in Ohio, in the Cincinnati area, and how to contact them if you're interested. Or we have the idea of the same thing, why Ohio in general. Again, Jobs Ohio posts information on foreign direct investment in Ohio, so we're trying to attract people here to do business in Ohio. All right, so let's think a little bit about the idea of the competitive advantages of nations. I alluded to that in the first slide or two. And we're going to take this from the perspective of Michael Porter. Michael Porter is a management marketing guru. And we look at what is called Porter's Diamond as we try to understand something about the dynamics of world trade. And the question we start is with why do some industries and firms become world leaders and others lose ground or fail? So this is what Michael's going to help us think about. And we start with what's called his diamond. You can see there's four things there. They interact with each other. It's in the shape of a diamond. So we're going to look at these four elements of his diamond, thinking about the competitive advantages of nations and the dynamics of world trade. So let's start with what he calls factor conditions. For example, you can't change whether or not you have gold, tin, platinum, or diamonds. That's something that's just there, right? So your natural resources are a factor condition. The education and the skill levels of your population, certainly something we would want to know about if we were marketing to a country or going to go in and invest in a country. Wage rates. We know for a long time U.S. business has chased low wage rates around the world, right? First we went to Mexico, and then we went to China, and then we went to Bangladesh. Some of it's come back to bite us, but we chase wage rates around on the production side. Kuwait, as we know, perhaps specializes in the production of oil. That gives them a competitive advantage. Hollywood is the film production star, as it has a concentration of skilled labor and excellent film schools. That's not to totally ignore another major player in film industry out of India, not called Hollywood, but called Bollywood. They also have a different set of skills there. Japan is an interesting situation. Japan, of course, is an island nation. They don't have a vast amount of raw materials domestically. They've had to do a lot with a little. So their relative lack of raw materials help them to focus on things like miniaturization, making things smaller and smaller, using less and less of things because they don't have a lot of raw materials. Just-in-time inventory delivery was one of their ideas, so it's not to have a lot of waste. Zero defect manufacturing. These things, these factor conditions, helped give them a certain position in the world. From a business viewpoint, from a marketing viewpoint, we might look at these factor conditions and ask, given the natural resources, the education and skills level of the laborers, the wage rates, can we produce in this country? Does it make sense? Would be one thing to think about. Demand conditions are another issue in the dynamics of world trade. How big is the market for the product or service you're thinking about compared to what? Other opportunities you have. Oops, am I going too fast? You need to back up?
Yeah, just for 1 second.
Okay,
sorry.
That's okay. Now I need a little vodka here anyhow. Just give me a chance. Water. Oh, I am. Demand conditions. So how big is the market? How sophisticated are the consumers? Did I talk about the baby food example in Africa? I talked about Nestle's milk. Did I talk about the baby food? Well, let me talk about the baby food again. Even if I did, you'll bear with me, okay? I'll tell them. So, what's the difference? Well, let me rephrase it. If you're illiterate doesn't mean you're stupid. What does illiterate mean? You can't read or write. Does that mean you're stupid? It means that perhaps in your society you don't have the education required to learn to read or write, or it's not important in your society. If you live in such a society and you're going into a store to buy stuff, you may still make money, you just not be able to read or write. You have a jillion packages there. How do you know what you're buying? Price. Well, you might be able to pay a price, but what's the thing there you're buying? How do you know what it is?
Pictures.
Okay. So you look at the pictures, you know what you're buying, you pay a price. Yeah. But you can't read it. I'm told it's a true story. I haven't researched it. So American manufacturers go into Africa, where not all, but some areas have an illiterate population. They cannot read, they cannot write, they are not very sophisticated. What do we often show on jars of baby food to advertise our products? What do you see on the jar? An image of a baby. So what did the consumers read was in the jar? Ground up babies. It wasn't a big seller. That's not, of course, the consumer's fault. That's the marketer's fault for not realizing the degree of sophistication of the consumer. That's sort of a silly example. But what about the information you provide on your website, the information in your brochures, how to put things together, the marketing itself, the promotional stuff? How sophisticated are the consumers? What are the media exposure habits of those consumers when they go to look for products? Where are they looking? One place in China, somewhere else in Romania. So, German consumers have demanded a high level of engineering in their cars. So that's one reason why we find cars like Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Porsche. Those consumers have demanded high level of engineering, and those brands have allowed Germany to dominate the world in high performance cars. On the other hand, German consumers are not crazy about cheap, mass-produced cars. So those don't do very well in that market due to the sophistication of the consumers. So this causes us to ask the question, is there a demand for our product as it's currently sold? A third element in his diamond, as we think about competitive advantages of nations and the dynamics of world trade, is related and supported industries. Are there supplier clusters in this country you think about doing business in that would help support you? For example, we have national strengths associated with clusters of industries. Silicon Valley in the USA has an advantage in chips, when we can get them. In Germany, there are clusters around chemicals. So if you're thinking about going into a particular nation to do business, can you get the support you need given their supplier clusters or not? And finally, we have the idea of the company strategy, structure, and rivalry in the country. We're thinking about going and marketing our product in this particular company. How many companies are already there selling whatever it is you sell? Might be nice to know. How intense is the competition in the country? Are you about to go into a fairly weak competitive market? You're strong. Are you about to go bump heads against some really successful players? You might want to know that. Is the competition owned by the government, Or is it private ownership? Government can dump a lot of money into your competition, causing them to succeed where you can't. So competition can certainly drive innovation, can drive upgrades. For a small country, Japan at one point in time had 9 major car competitors domestically, plus foreign markets, causing them to have to succeed with innovation, have to have innovation in order to succeed. The first drink holders in cars, Toyota. Who has a car that doesn't have a cup holder now? But they were the first ones out there to get a competitive advantage. So, can you be competitive in this market against the competition that's already out there, structured the way it is, and the rivalry that they have there? So as these various factors play out across different countries, you can see different issues, different problems, different chances of success. So firms that succeed in these global markets first have to have succeeded in intense domestic competition through continuous improvement. We're pretty weak here in the U.S. Let's go try our hand in France. What? Through innovation, forced on you by the rapidly changing environment in which you operate, and through the ability to manage change. You can't manage change at home. Now you're going to go internationally. It doesn't make sense. What are some trends in the global economic world today? Well, obviously, depending on which administration we're looking at and which country we're looking at, we have issues of economic protectionism. Under the previous administration, were we more in favor of protectionism to the domestic market, or were we more in favor of open markets? The previous administration, 50-50 chance of being right, I don't really care. Which one? Protectionism, right? U.S. first, make America great again, forget about these other nations, they'll worry about themselves. Nationalism, protectionism. Less so under the current administration, who's, relatively speaking, back involved in global affairs. So the prior U.S. administration favored economic protectionism. The current one is more in favor of open trade. But the question would be, should Congress use political situations as a reason for more protectionism? Some politicians argue that the benefit of today's free trade system go unfairly and primarily to low-wage countries, which take jobs away from Americans. Factually, that's not the case, but that doesn't mean in the world of politics it doesn't hold sway. Americans' economy over the past several decades has proved that openness, coupled with flexibility, makes the economic pie much bigger for everybody. The benefits occur here and elsewhere in the world. Now, of course, your particular town, your particular industry, your particular family might be hit negatively by some international trade going on. But overall, right, for the nation, for the countries, for the economies, open trade grows it for everyone. That isn't to say that some people don't get hurt as others grow. It's been a while, but President Ronald Reagan, who was a Republican, said a creative, competitive America is the answer to a changing world, not trade wars that would close doors, create greater barriers, and destroy millions of jobs. We should always remember that protectionism is destructionism. I don't know if that's a real word or not, but that's what he said. So obviously, he favored the idea of more open trade relations. Now, the China-U.S. trade situation is an ongoing conflict between China and the U.S. 2018, President Trump began setting tariffs and other trade barriers on China with the goal of forcing it to make changes to what the U.S. says are unfair trade practices. Among those trade practices and their effects are the growing trade deficit, which we just talked about, the theft of intellectual property, and there is no doubt that the China laws, regulations, government, and culture do allow for the theft of your intellectual property. It's a real thing. It's a real problem. It does cost U.S. businesses a lot of revenue and profit. And the forced transfer of American technology to China. So these are bad practices, even in a large economic opportunity area. The trade war itself negatively impacted the economies of both the U.S. and China. In the United States, it led to higher prices for consumers and for financial difficulties for farmers and manufacturers who were then in turn blocked from selling their products in China. In China, economic growth and growth of manufacturing activity slowed to their lowest rates in decades because of these tariffs. In other countries, it's also caused economic damage, though some countries benefited from increased manufacturing to fill the gaps. These people get hurt, these people benefit. China has been, for example, GM's largest retail sales market since 2012, bigger than the U.S., bigger than the EU. But a favorable relationship between the U.S. and China is important for maintaining its business relationships within the country. The pandemic, a weakening Chinese economy, and trade wars with the U.S. have all impacted GM sales in China. Interesting impact, unintended consequences of these, you know, I presume well-intended actions. So what do we have here? GM sales in China in the U.S. 2018, 2019, 2020. In the U.S., 18, 19, 20. So we see the impact of the pandemic pretty strong. We see the impact of administrative policies also pretty strong. So things have been struggling. So, protectionism comes in two main forms, tariffs and quotas. Somebody help me out. What is a tariff? What is a tariff?
Don't help me. You tell me, because I need anything.
Yeah.
From what I remember, a tariff is something that you place on a certain product, so that when it comes to your country, we have to make it more clear.
Okay, so a tariff is a fee or a tax on a good or service that comes into your country, and its main effect is to increase the retail price on those imports. In general, ignoring what's going on in our country today, in general, what happens when you increase prices? What happens to demand? In general, the demand goes down. We're just going to ignore the pandemic effects on Coke and Pepsi right now. It's nutty. What's a quota then? What's a quota? Actually, I'm going to catch somebody else. Person over there? Quota? All right. Well, it's not that they have to achieve, but it's a number that limits what they can bring in. So quotas are a restriction placed on the amount of a product allowed to enter a country or leave a country. So tariffs increase prices, quotas limit supply. So what effect do tariffs and quotas have on global trade, on world trade? Both of them have the same effect, which is to decrease world trade. It's not clear how that's a good thing. Decrease in world trade. It may hurt the other countries, but it's also hurting you. So protectionism is destructionism, is the stance we're going to take here for now. We good? So when we think about how these countries agree to work together with one another, we go back in history a little bit, and then we'll bring it forward, but to make you smarter. After World War II, we had a series of agreements among countries, and from our perspective in this domain, we start with the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT. GATT was a treaty. There was no organization most effective between 47 and 94. And given the status of world trade at the time, the treaty focused on products, merchandise. Not on services, they weren't a big thing. And the big problem with the treaty was there was no mechanism for solving the dispute. You say, I'm not honoring the treaty. I say, I am honoring the treaty. Now what? There was no mechanism in place. So after a while, they got to thinking about that a little bit. By the way, anybody here GATT? No. So after a while, they got to think about it, and they came up with something different. World Trade Organization. Who's heard of the WTO? Okay, so that's the more updated version of the GATT. Its goal is trade without discrimination. The ideal case for the World Trade Organization, which they know is going to be really not plausible to achieve anytime soon, would be that everybody trades freely with everybody else. No quotas, no tariffs. We just do open business. Realistically, though, they recognize that regional trade agreements, NAFTA, the EU stuff, stuff going on in Indonesia, those things occur. So they're going to support those when they have to. They would like to have predictable and growing access to markets. If you're going to have tariffs, make them binding. Don't allow people to tinker with them in midstream, because that's not a good way to do business. You don't know tomorrow what the deal's going to be. Promote fair competition among all the countries in the world, so we're not giving discriminatory advantages to some countries and discriminatory disadvantages to others. And to encourage development and economic reform. Over 3/4 of the members of the WTO are developing countries. So what I'm going to show here, I recognize fully drones on for a little bit, but the guy we're going to hear from was a guy who taught in our Geneva program, Kent State University Geneva program. He was the chief economist at the World Trade Organization. If you get together with him after hours, after a class, and you have a couple of drinks together, he's a jolly good fellow. I have some pictures of that. Right now, though, he's talking in a public domain, and he goes into a very droney voice about what's going to go on with the WTO and their goals and objectives. It's pretty monotone. But we're going to hear for a few minutes Patrick Lowe, the retired chief economist at the World Trade Organization, talking in a particular venue about the WTO and its goals and objectives.
My name is Patrick Lowe. I'm the chief economist at the World Trade Organization. We are an international trade agreement amongst a highly diverse and quite large membership of 150 members. So ours is an agreement. We're not a funding institution of any kind. We're a place where governments come to talk about trade policy, to agree on rules about trade policy, and to agree about the conditions of access to each other's markets. I expect the Commission to take a fresh look at some of the pressing issues facing the multilateral trading system today, and the trading system more generally, international trade relations more generally. In many ways, we're at turning points in the conduct and organization of international trade. And this is an opportune moment for some knowledgeable outsiders, most of the Commission are outsiders, to give some new insights, some fresh insights, different ways of looking at things. It's a multidisciplinary body that has huge advantages too. Trade and increasing integration through trade is one of the key features of globalization today. So cooperation is at a premium. And the challenge we have is to make sure that this is a kind of cooperation from which we get buy-in from all nations, all interests. And that is very easy to say and rather hard to do. Interests are diverse, priorities are different. And the question is, how can we bring all these diverse interests together in a way that leads to mutual benefit among the cooperating parties? Bilateralism and regionalism more generally has exploded exponentially in the last decade or two. And it does raise the question of what the role of the multilateral trading system, the so-called non-discriminatory basis of the multilateral trading system, is obviously challenged by regional and bilateral agreements. But these regional and bilateral agreements exist for a reason. Governments have seen it in their interests to strike these agreements. I think our job as the, if you like, the core focal point of international trade relations among almost all nations is to play for coherence, to try to ensure as much coherence as possible in these different arrangements, to try to see if we can make a contribution to minimizing the costs involved in crisscrossing arrangements, often competing in many ways. A situation where a pair of countries will negotiate something and then one of those countries will then negotiate something with somebody else, and that will immediately depreciate what was negotiated in the first agreement, and all the mess that follows from complex networks of rules of origin and differentiated conditions of market access. Even though it's clear that governments see value in making these agreements, I think there is an awareness that they're not always the best way of carrying forward harmonious and integrated international trade relations of the kind that the WTO seeks to promote. On the other hand, it's a lot easier sometimes to make agreements among a few countries rather than try to get a universe of countries to agree on things. I think one of the big challenges for the WTO is to ensure that these don't become excessively discriminatory against outsiders. As far as possible, they should be open and inclusive, not exclusive and discriminatory, even if in their fundamental nature they have some discrimination in them. Can we look to a future where this crisscrossing network of agreements will eventually become more generalized into multilaterally oriented agreements, where we'll be able to eliminate some of these efficiency costs and difficulties associated with overlapping and potentially excluding agreements. Some developing countries have gone quite a long way in establishing regional agreements amongst themselves, but I think many of them rely very heavily on the multilateral trading system as a bedrock of international rules, where governments make pre-commitments to certain types of policy behavior. I think many developing countries would be quite concerned if they thought that regional arrangements were simply going to substitute for the multilateral trading system. So I think they look to the multilateral trading system to provide stability and continuity and a certain degree of predictability that is not necessarily present in regional arrangements. I think the relative weights of negotiating influence and power are quite different within regional agreements, especially if they're between developed and developing countries and in the multilateral setting. So I think developing countries need to look at both in order to see where they can extract the maximum benefit. It's difficult to put a very clear meaning on the notion of equity in trade relations other than that we create a level playing field in which there is equality of opportunity in some sense. I think that's what the system seeks to do. Of course, there are many things that can legitimately be criticized about the system in relation to whether or not the rules are fair. But over time, I think there's an evolutionary process by which the rules do become more balanced in the direction of serving the interests of a growing number of countries that have real stakes in international trade.
So again, I know that's a little That's a little dense, obviously, to be listening to. But he's talking about these basic ideas. We need cooperation from these 150 member countries. We're trying to set up trade without discrimination. I mean, I don't know that anything more about avocados than I just talked about earlier. But imagine that we said that we're only going to import avocados from North American, whatever our new name is, for the North American Trade Association, and anything else is going to have a tariff put on it. So if you're in Peru manufacturing or growing perfectly good avocados, you don't have a fair and equitable access to our market. And then all of a sudden we change our policy because there's some other thing going on with Mexico. Things shift. How about things that are equitable, fair, stable? Just for fun, this is a group I used to take of undergrad and grad students to the World Trade Organization in Geneva. I don't know if you can tell, this is Patrick Lowe wearing a pair of cheap KSU sunglasses. After several beers, he's sitting with some of the co-eds, which he enjoyed doing. I think he bought us all dinner, as I recall. He was a good guy. So that's the discussion from the World Trade Organization. So we have 150 countries in the World Trade Organization. How many countries are there in the world today, ignoring whatever's going on in Europe right at the moment? How many?
Total.
Yeah, no reason you know, I'm just playing here, so. 256? 196. So, there are 196 countries in the world today, 150 in the WTO, unless you don't count Taiwan.
Yeah, unless you don't count certain countries.
Well, Taiwan would be the one. Taiwan is not considered an official country by many, which would bring the count down to 195 countries, so 150 in the WTO. Although Taiwan does operate, up till now, as an independent country, many countries, including the U.S., do not officially recognize it as one because the People's Republic of China considers Taiwan a breakaway province of China. Countries who wish to maintain diplomatic relations with China have had to sever their formal relationships with Taiwan. More than 100 countries, however, have unofficial relations with Taiwan, including, of course, the U.S. All right, so let's think about the second trend, away from protectionism to integration. We all know about the EU, I trust, right? The European Union consists of 27 countries as of Brexit in 2020, with more than 440 million customers, 330 in the US, 430 in the EU. That's a fair number of consumers to think about. It operates an internal or single market, which allows free movement of goods, capital, services, and people between its member states. So when you cross a border, just like you go from Ohio to Pennsylvania, they don't stop you and ask for your passport. They don't charge you a tax or whatever. You just go from one country to another. That was quite exciting the first time we were able to take a bus from, where did we go? We took a bus from France into Germany without being stopped at all. It was like, what? Where's passport control? So, they always tease Americans about not knowing where anything is on a map. So there is the EU without Britain. What's that funny gray splotch in the middle of the EU that isn't part of the EU? Let's see if we get anybody else going. Try some other contributors here. Yeah, I'm trying to get somebody other than the front row. I'll come back to you guys in a second if I can't get anybody else. What's that splotch up there? Nada? Webbies. No, you can't help me. Yes! Switzerland! Switzerland is not a member of the EU. Why not? Switzerland is a neutral country. Switzerland runs its own banking system, which they do very nicely with, thank you. So Switzerland is neutral in terms of politics, neutral in terms of economics. So right in the center we have EU, a non-EU country, Switzerland. There's the rest of the ones that are. There's another version of the map with the EU as of the exit of Brexit, 27 countries. We do have the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement that took effect in July of 2020, replacing NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Organization. What countries are involved in that? You ought to be able to figure it out pretty easily. Yes? What countries? Thank you. U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Well, you and me were the only two people that were getting it here. I don't know. Thank you. So that's the three countries up here. Though NAFTA is officially expired, governments and companies are still adjusting to the new rules, most notably the new labor provisions of the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. The coronavirus may also complicate the implications as manufacturers will be adapting to new guidelines in the middle of this exciting global economic crisis. For the visual learners, there's our three countries involved in the USMCA on a map. Over in Asia, we have the Asia Free Trade Agreement, an economic integration in that area of the country. The South Asian Free Trade Agreement is an agreement that created a free trade zone like the EU, like ours, with more than 1.8 billion people, including India, Pakistan, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Bhutan, and the Maldives. And they also have the East Asian Free Trade Agreement on services. So these are multilateral, to use Patrick Lowe's term, agreements among a variety of countries in an area to come together in economic unity. So there we are over in that part of the world. Global competition is a third trend as we think about global trade. Who are we up against? How might we compete in this difficult world of international trade? We have enough stuff, problems trying to be successful domestically. How are we going to do it internationally? Well, one approach is to engage in a strategic alliance. In this case, we have two independent firms who agree to cooperate for the purpose of achieving common goals internationally. For example, we know the brand Cheerios, yes? Do we associate in the United States Cheerios with the brand Nestle's? You shouldn't. We don't. So Nestle's breakfast cereals are manufactured by Cereal Partners, a joint venture between Nestle's and General Mills, who has Cheerios in the U.S. Cereal Partners is one of the U.K.'s leading cereal manufacturers and also makes many of the leading U.K. retailer brand cereals you know as well. You'll recognize many of our well-known brands like Shredded Wheat, got that, Shreddies, don't know that one, and Cheerios. So Nestle's and Cheerios, strategic partnerships to be successful in another part of the world. International firms. In international firms, international marketing is done in the same way that we do domestic marketing. So we make very limited changes in the international market. Belron is a vehicle glass repair and replacement group operating worldwide in 34 countries. They're using the same, they use pretty much the same jingle globally. Auto glass repair, auto glass replace. Okay, so if you caught the jingle, as such as it was, it ought to sound familiar to you because it's very similar to the one we have. Safe Flight Repair, Safe Flight Replace. Does that ring a bell?
What makes a Safe Flight Repair different? We're always there for you. Okay, you can Mike. Schedule any time.
So they're using very similar approach throughout the countries that they operate in as sort of an international firm. A multinational firm approach is when we have a multi-domestic marketing strategy. The point, we're going to vary the marketing mix for each country. To some extent, Nestle's has quite different brands in different countries of the world. These ones we do and don't recognize. Let's see if we can find some. So we know Gerber's, yes? We might know Nature's, but we probably know Cerelac and pretty much don't know Nido, I think. Different brands in different countries of the world based on what those countries need. Anybody know Maggi? I think you can get Maggi here in the States, but it's not a big thing in the U.S. compared to others. Hot Pocket Stirpers, Tomy, Herta. I don't think we know Herta. Sorry, Stirpers is the U.S. brand for Nestle's. Where's Nestle's headquartered?
Solon.
Say again. Oh, Solon. Well, that's Solon for Hot Pockets or whatever it is here. That is for Stirpers here. Where's Nestle's headquartered? International marketing.
I don't know. I just know the one that I drive by to go to.
You're driving by from their perspective, that foreign, you know, that foreign investment place. So Stouffer's would be a foreign investment for Nestle's. Nestle's headquartered in Vevey, Switzerland. So that's their national headquarters, although they do a good job of marketing it locally, so it seems like it's a local brand. All right, so multinational, vary the marketing mix in each country. So here we have Nestle's headquartered in Vevey, Switzerland, where we might have the centralized focus on product positioning, branding and logoing, packaging, pricing, but then we break it down and change it in the U.S., in France, in Italy, in Germany, where we have their particular advertising, channel distribution, etc. A transnational firm is a different approach to engaging in global competition. Here, we're going to use a global marketing strategy to standardize the marketing mix where we have cultural similarities and change the marketing mix when cultures differ. Although I exaggerate a little bit when I talk about Nestle's doing different things in every country they operate in, that's a little exaggeration, but there are 150 companies of the world, countries in the world, more than that, what do we say? 150 countries in the WTO. How would you like to manage an organization that had to run different marketing mixes, price, promotion, distribution, product, in 150 countries? It would be crazy. Most places don't get that extreme. But what if we could arrange to standardize things where things were common and only change things where we had to change things because of cultural differences? So the goal of a transnational firm is to create and maintain a balanced portfolio of global brands and local brands to take advantages of economies of scale where we can. To the extent that a whole bunch of countries don't care about any differences in this element, we can share our research and development, share the technical features, share manufacturing across all of these brands. Grow our global brands where we can, and then where we need to differentiate locally because the culture is different, obtain market penetration by changing the marketing mix locally when necessary. I'll talk about Henkel next time, I think. So let's wrap it up for today. Midterm 1 opens tomorrow. Don't forget to take Midterm 1. Mini Test 5 closes today. Don't forget to take Mini Test 5, please. Thank you.